9751.
9751? What? Is that pesos? This is for a dong. This is dong food. 9751? I'm not gonna eat this stuff. Did I buy smoked salmon? 9750. What? How much if I take this back? I'd like to talk to Kevin. Can you call him, please? Kevin!
Yes, welcome to a very special episode of Out of Touch Zone. When we wrapped up 1988, we thought we'd have fun and do like a nice year in review episode. And so why not just keep it going? Now we've come to the end of 1989. Again, my name is Mike DeKalb. Thanks for tuning in. Across the Skype line is my co-host, Chad Smart. Chad, are you ready to wrap up the decade of the 80s with Touchstone films?
I am. And you said this is a very special episode. Does that mean one of us is going to face our drinking addiction, or we're going to talk about something? We're going to have a life lesson moment here at the end of this episode, like all good 80s sitcoms had on their very special episodes.
Sure. I think what's going to end up happening is we're going to discover that I have lupus.
It's never lupus.
Oh, but in this case, it will be, and that's what will make it such a special episode.
And this is where I think you should throw in a sound clip from Bad News Bears, where when the characters is going off about the lupus character.
Okay. Yeah. We'll see. Well, let's focus on the Touchstone films. There were eight movies that Touchstone released in 1989, as compared to 10 from 1988. I don't want to compare year after year, but I guess it's easy to look back at just the year before it. So we'll do that throughout this episode as we go on. I guess we'll just get right into it. If there's anything that you have on 1989, I think we did last time out, we began by talking about some of the people who were born or died in 1988. So we can do that for 1989. Chad, what have you found for us?
All right. Well, I've got a few births, some few deaths, and then four little pop culture references to put us in. And let's start with the pop culture reference, because that will put us into the frame of mind of what was going on in 1989. It's hard to imagine, but once upon a time, there was a time when The Simpsons didn't exist, and that was pre-1989. The first episode. Yeah.
And that's true. I mean, I guess it would have been on Tracy Ullman, but...
I think the Christmas episode may have premiered in December of 89. I didn't look up exactly. Yeah. I just saw that The Simpsons had premiered. Another classic television show that premiered in 1989. And, you know, it's not bad enough that The Simpsons have been on 31 years, and that makes me feel old already. But when I find out that Saved by the Bell premiered in 1989...
Oh, sure. Yeah, I remember that because, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't 90210 also start around that time? Or at least, because I know this because in 1989, a 13-year-old Mike DeKalb started high school. And I remember because I graduated the same year as Saved by the Bell and 90210. We all graduated in 1993.
There you go.
So unless 90210 started when they were sophomores or something.
Yeah, I don't have that, but it's the timing seems right. I can't remember because, again, at this time where I was living, we didn't have a Fox affiliate. So the only reason I got to watch Simpsons is my cousin would record them off. He had his family had the big satellite dishes that were popular in the 80s. He would record Simpsons and Married with Children on Sunday and bring them into school, and we would watch them during social studies class.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Sega Genesis was released, providing the first, you know, console wars, if you will.
I did have that. I was one of the last kids in my neighborhood to have a Nintendo, but one of the first to have a Sega Genesis in 1989,
Yeah, and then to tie into Touchstone, the Disney MGM Studio theme park opened. It is now known as Disney Hollywood Studios down in Orlando, but and you know what that gave us? The all-new Mickey Mouse Club.
Oh, okay.
That's where they recorded.
We talked about that with, like, Cocktail. I think Cocktail was filmed down there before the park opened, and Ernest Saves Christmas was filmed in that area before as the park was opening, right? Yeah, so. And now the park's going to be hopefully reopening by the time this podcast comes out. Maybe it'll be reopened.
Hopefully so. And if you ever go down there, I highly recommend the Aerosmith Rock and Roller Coaster. It has nothing to do with Disney or Hollywood, but it's an awesome indoor roller coaster.
Okay.
All right. Now, for celebrities born in 1989, Mike, I'm going to test you. You know who I'm going to start off with. Who is probably the most famous person born in 1989?
Born in 1989, huh?
Yeah.
That would be 31. I did not look, Chad. I did not do my research ahead of time on that particular thing. I left it up to you. So go ahead and school me.
Well, I thought you would know it because she named one of her albums 1989.
Oh, duh. That duh. Is, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
T-Swizzle. One of my faves, T-Swizz, Taylor Swift. And then we also have Nicholas Holt, who I believe is an X-Men. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not. I don't know. I just know yeah. I've heard the name. Okay.
Beast.
But, oh, is he Beast in the...
He was, yeah.
Okay. Hayden Panettiere, or however you say her last name. Harry Potter himself, Daniel Radcliffe. And I believe
oh my God.
In 1988, we either had Emma Watson or Rupert Grint were born, so...
These people all born when we were in high school. Okay, sure. Yeah.
Well, Blake Griffin, who, you know, star basketball player. McLovin, Christopher Mintz Plaza, please, however you say his last name.
Who Chad and I both ran into at a Pearl Jam concert in Los Angeles a few years back. Yeah.
And then the last one I have, she's not part of the twin, and she's not a triplet, but probably the most successful actress in her family, Elizabeth Olsen.
Oh, okay, sure.
Yes. And then as far as deaths we go, a few of the names, legendary names that we lost in 1989, the artist Salvador Dali, who I put on here just because of his association with Alice Cooper, so I can get that reference in.
And we always like to mention that, you know, when Chad and I were traveling around the country going to all these NHL arenas, one of my favorite trips was when we were in Tampa to see the Tampa Bay Lightning. We drove to St. Petersburg and went to the Salvador Dali Museum, and I cannot recommend that enough. I had such a blast at that place.
Yeah. Oh, yes. The tour by that was narrated by Salvador Dali's mustache is probably one of the best things I've ever experienced.
Yes.
Yes. We also lost Lucille Ball.
Okay.
Yeah. Gilda Radner.
Mm.
Jim Backus from Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah.
And also
Gilligan's Island.
Gilligan's Island and Mr. Magoo for those less cultured people.
Oh, yes.
The man of a thousand voices, Mel Blanc. Blank. However you say his last name. And then one that, you know, kind of was a shock to everybody in the manner that it happened is Rebecca Schaefer. I don't know if you remember her.
She was the actress that was on,
My Sister Sam.
Sitcom. My Sister Sam. Okay.
With Pam Dauber. And yeah, I think the show had actually recently been canceled and a deranged fan showed up at her place and when she answered the door, he shot her. So,
that was unfortunate. And I think that also started some laws, didn't it?
I would hope
some
so.
Laws in place.
Yeah,
after
I would
that?
Hope yeah. so. But now we have paparazzi, which it's a different type of shooting, but I think we should get laws on the books regarding them as well. But that's my own personal opinion.
For sure. For sure. Okay, well, I guess if there's nothing else, let's just go right into Touchstone Films. As I mentioned, there were only 8 releases from 1989. Not as good of a year as 1988, but that's all relative, I guess. The biggest, we'll just go through all 8 of them. We'll rank them in the as far as highest grossing to lowest grossing and where they finish on the year-end box office chart. The highest grossing Touchstone film for 1989 was Dead Poets Society, which finished 10th. At the year in box office, it made $95.9 million. Turner and Hooch was 16th with $71.1 million. Three Fugitives was 31st with $40.6 million. An Innocent Man was 53rd with $20 million. Blaze was 56th with $19.1 million. And then Grey's Anatomy finished 77th with $11.6 million. New York Stories was 81st. With $10.8 million. And finally, rounding it out was Disorganized Crime, finished in 98th place with $7.7 million. Interesting to note that all 8 of those movies did finish in the top 100, where in 1988, Touchstone released 10 movies, and 3 of the 10 finished outside the top 100. However, on the plus side, in 1988, 6 of the 10 Touchstone films made more than $25 million. Whereas in 1989, only 3 of their 8 releases made $25 million. As a whole, Touchstone grossed $276.8 million in their 8 films, which accounts for approximately $34.6 million apiece. Again, by comparison, 1988, Touchstone made $418.1 million amongst 10 films, which was $41.8 million per. So just a slight step down from 1988. Now, granted, Who Framed Roger Rabbit kind of carried a lot of that load, but it seems like it was there were not as many huge hits, but not as many bombs, like The Good Mother, for example. So they were doing okay for themselves. And then also doing okay for themselves was Disney itself. Walt Disney Pictures released 5 movies in 1989. The highest grossing one was Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which finished 5th at the year-end box office with $130.7 million. The Little Mermaid was 13th with $84.4 million. And they'd had 2 re-releases. Peter Pan finished 41st with $29.4 million. And The Rescuers finished 51st with $21.2 million. And rounding out Disney's slate was Cheetah, which finished in 92nd place with only $8.2 million. And as we wrap up the 80s, I thought it was interesting to note that since Touchstone began in 1984, they released 36 films in the 6 years of their existence. In that same time frame, Disney only released 12 films, which I thought that was kind of interesting. We're going to see that pick up a little bit as the 90s roll along, and we'll talk about that as we go along on our show. But for now, let's wrap up 1989, and I'm going to have Chad give us the top 10 films at the box office that year. Go ahead, Chad.
All right. Now, you said Touchstone made $280 million collectively in 1989?
276,
yeah. 276, okay, I rounded up. Well, your number one movie made $251 million by itself. And that, of course, 1989 was all about the summer of Batman.
Oh, yes. I remember how difficult it was to try to get a ticket for that when it first came out. How many times did you see Batman in the theater?
Once.
Just the one?
Yeah, I could probably count, not counting repertory theaters, you know, that we visit here in the Los Angeles area. I can probably count on one hand the number of movies that I've purposely seen at a theater more than once during its initial run.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just remember, like I said, it was difficult to get a ticket. I remember what was funny was when movies would come to Hawaii, I don't know if I talked about it on this show or not, but they would only play in like a couple of theaters. Mm-hmm. One big theater downtown and then another one that was a drive-in. And so I remember one of my friends was like, hey, let's meet up and go see Batman. I remember this is pre-cell phones and stuff. So they said, we're going to go see it Tuesday afternoon at this time. And I said, great. And I went to the mall and I got to the mall and it wasn't playing. And I was kind of like, what? And I talked to those guys later, and they're like, oh, yeah, it was downtown at this theater. And I felt like such an idiot, not even bothering to look in the paper or call ahead. And so I didn't see it until I saw it at the drive-in. Like, it'd probably been out for a month or two before I finally got around to seeing it, yeah.
Now, speaking of Batman, when it was announced that they were going to be doing it and who was going to be playing Batman, this was my reaction. I'll see if you had a similar one. I said, what? The kid from Family Ties is playing Batman? That doesn't seem... Because for some reason, I confused Michael Keaton with Michael J. Fox playing Alex Keaton. And, yeah.
Sure, sure.
All right. Well, we'll save further Batman discussions for the Warner Brothers podcast. We'll start up in a few years.
Yeah.
All right. Number two was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the very last Indiana Jones movie that was ever made, ever in time and space.
Yeah.
And it made $197 million. Number three, you know, this is, not the start of the sequelitis, but definitely one of the few sequels that I can think of off the top of my head that made more money probably than the original. And that's Lethal Weapon 2 with $147 million. Mm-hmm. And as we learned in that movie, you never go to the drive-thru.
I think I saw it in the theater, but I don't remember a whole lot about it other than that scene where Mel Gibson ties that the support of that house to his truck and pulls the guy's house off a cliff. And of course, diplomatic immunity is such a great line.
Yes. Number four is Look Who's Talking with $140 million.
Again, another one of those movies that it took me a couple of times to go into the movies before I could finally get in because it was always sold out.
Yeah, I can't remember if I mentioned this on previous episode or if I just mentioned it to you off air, but I'll mention it again just in case. When my cousin and I went to see Back to the Future 2, we were standing in line, and Back to the Future 2 actually sold out, which where I live, movies selling out was a rarity. And so we're getting close to the box office. We're trying to figure out what else we're going to go see instead. I can't find my money. So when we get into the lobby, we just kind of step off to the side while I'm looking for it. And I realize that no one is paying attention because it's so busy. And we snuck right into Look Who's Talking and watched it for free. So, I don't know if I'd be brave enough to do that now, but
yeah,
especially with now that everything has assigned seating, you can't just sneak in and hope no one shows up. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, as you mentioned, at number five is Honey, I Shrunk the Kids with $130 million. Number six, as I just mentioned, and I'm kind of surprised this one came in this low, but it's Back to the Future Part Two with $118 million. Yeah.
That is surprising. Maybe it's just because it had been 4 years, because we ran to the theater to see that as soon as we could. I remember,
Or
you
maybe,
know, much as everyone loves the first one, you know?
Well, and this is also the calendar that we're using is the in-year release date. So maybe if you adjust for, because this came out, I believe, in November, so it probably played well into 1989. I don't know if this is counting 1989 receipts as well. Maybe that's a factor. Number seven is Ghostbusters 2, which is a sequel that I'm surprised was that high, given, you know, the reputation that it has. And it made $112 million. Number eight, a movie we'll talk about a little bit later in more detail, Driving Miss Daisy with $106 million. Number nine, another movie filmed in the Florida Disney region, and it takes place in Missouri outside St. Louis, but if you look closely when they're driving down the highway, you will see signs for Florida, and that is Parenthood, which just barely crossed the $100 million mark.
I've never seen that movie, so yeah, I don't know.
And then number 10, again, as you mentioned earlier, Dead Poets Society with $95 million. So that's your top 10. I do have some other films listed that, you know, if you want me to go through and
shoot.
Okay. Again, I like to go through and just see where movies that we now hold dear to our hearts, where they finished for the year. So I've got about 10 movies here. Number 15, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation came in at 15, as I just said, with $71 million. Number 20, one of your favorite buddy cop films, Tango and Cash, came in nice. With $63 million. And we are recording this on June 9th, which is also now known, I guess, as Bill and Ted Day, because it's 6-9. And,
oh, God.
And the new trailer for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure 3, Face the Music, just came out today. But Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure came in at 32nd place at the box office with $40 million. Beating out The Burbs, which came in at 34 with $36 million. You know, classic Tom Hanks.
Sure.
Number 36 is License to Kill. I believe this is Timothy Dalton's first Bond.
No, second.
Second
and final.
Okay. So his last Bond film came in $34 million. So there's our James Bond connection for the show. Number 39, Weekend at Bernie's, $30 million. And I was surprised to see this falling just $160 million shy of Weekend at Bernie's. Coming in at number 40 is Roadhouse.
Okay.
Yeah. And then my last two, number 64, probably the greatest movie to star Hulk Hogan. It's No Holds Barred, made $16 million. And then we talked about the movies that made, actually, I'm sorry, I have three more. At 105th place was UHF with $6 million, which I believe it opened against Batman and Weird Al.
I told that to Weird Al when I met him. I said, everyone said 1989 was the summer of Batman, but for me, it was the summer of UHF. When I met him, and he autographed my DVD copy of UHF. I ran to the theater to see UHF. I had the soundtrack on cassette. I was totally on with Weird Al at that time, yeah.
Yeah, and I've got him to sign my copy of UHF to it when I met him several years ago now. And then two movies, because I'm a huge Christian Slater fan, it kind of breaks my heart to see how poorly these movies did at the theater. But 135th place was Gleaming the Cube, with $2,777,000. And to tie into Disney, there is a scene in the movie, because it takes place in Anaheim, where they show the old Disneyland sign that used to stand out front of Disneyland. And then this one was probably the most shocking, at 166th place for the year, with just barely over $1 million, is Heathers.
Now, that's shocking only because of how great that movie is. Yeah. But, like, I don't know about you. I never heard about it until it was on cable.
Yeah.
Like
it probably
a year
got
later.
A limited release. And
well, I'm looking at the notes on Heathers right now, and I see that the most amount of theaters it was ever in for one particular week was 54. Okay. So,
that's
yeah. I think it kind of limited its ability to go wide. But, again, it's got a life of its own, and a lot of people who were in it and the people who wrote and directed it have gone on to do great things. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is your box office highlights for 1989. Yeah, that's all I've got.
Okay. Well, we'll switch to, we always like to look at the Oscars as well. Yep. In 1988, there were only two Touchstone films that got Oscar nominations. Beaches got one nomination, and Roger Rabbit got a whole slate of them and even won four awards. And the same thing basically happened in 1989. You had one movie do really well, another movie got one nomination, and then that was pretty much it. We'll start with Dead Poets Society, which got four Oscar nominations. Tom Schulman won for Best Original Screenplay, while Robin Williams was nominated for Best Actor, Peter Weir was nominated for Best Director, and then the film received a Best Picture nomination. The first Touchstone movie to receive a Best Picture nomination, and the last Touchstone movie for 10 whole years before another Touchstone movie gets a Best Picture nomination. And the other one, which was I was a little bit surprised by, was Blaze got an Oscar nomination for Best Cinematography for the great Haskell Wexler, who was one of the titans of that field. So,
well, is Haskell Wexler kind of like John Williams and Meryl Streep? If they make a movie, you just nominate them out of principle?
I think there was a while, because he seemed to be kind of raking them in. But as far as the rest of the 1989 Oscars, I'll once again kick it back over to Chad, and we'll look at some of the main categories as well and see what those ended up being.
All right, we'll start with Best Supporting Actress. And your nominees included Diane Wiest for Parenthood. This one shocked me, because I completely forgot about it. Julia Roberts for Steel Magnolias.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, and I keep forgetting that Steel Magnolias came out before another Touchstone film that we'll talk about in a future episode. And probably like three or four episodes, to be specific. Lena Olin for Enemies, A Love Story. I know the title, but I don't know anything about it. Also getting a nomination from Enemies, A Love Story is Angelica Houston. But your best supporting actress that year went to Brenda Fricker for My Left Foot. Okay. Have you seen My Left Foot?
I have not. I hear good things about it. Our mutual friend Eric Benes says that Daniel Day-Lewis's performance in that movie is one of the best acting he's ever seen, and seems to like that movie a lot, but I just missed it. The subject matter, I mean, maybe that didn't interest me, I guess. Yeah. Have you seen it?
No, I have not. I'm with you. When it came out, you know, again, being 15 years old, the movie did not appeal to 15-year-old me. So, and it's just one of those movies that I've never gone back and watched.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's switch gears to Best Supporting Actor now. You have Martin Landau getting a nomination for Crimes and Misdemeanors. Marlon Brando for A Dry White Season. Probably a shock to everybody who has followed this actor's career. Dan Aykroyd got a nomination for Driving Miss Daisy.
I think it's one of those ones where they were just like, hey, that movie did really well, and it's a favorite for the Best Picture, so let's just give an acting nomination. I don't really remember him in that movie. I mean, I know he was in it.
Yeah.
I don't remember him giving such an Oscar-worthy performance. Right. Yeah.
Danny Aiello for Do the Right Thing. And your winner, Denzel Washington for Glory. Another film that I've never seen, but I think I owned the DVD for about 6 years.
I saw it a while back. I remember it being really good. Just one of those ones that just kind of comes out. You like it, and then you just move on.
In the Best Actress category, we have Michelle Pfeiffer. These are the nominees. Michelle Pfeiffer for The Fabulous Baker Boys. Jessica Lange for Music Box. Pauline Collins for Shirley Valentine. You know anything about that movie?
I remember a commercial. Okay. It's one of the, you know, it's one of those ones, but like back when we had cable and you had pay-per-view, that movie, I remember popping up. I remember seeing a TV spot for it, but I don't think I know. I've never seen it. I'm not sure that I know anybody who has.
Yeah. Well, and how about this one? Isabel Adjani had a nomination for Camille Claudel.
Yeah, I don't know that one either. Yeah.
And then your winner, showing that age knows no limits in acting, Jessica Tandy for Driving Miss Daisy.
Yes. Okay.
And then in the Best Actor category, your nominees, you mentioned Robin Williams for Dead Poets Society, Morgan Freeman for Driving Miss Daisy, Tom Cruise for Born on the 4th of July, Kenneth Branagh for Henry V, and your winner, Daniel Day-Lewis for My Left Foot.
Like I said, I mean, he's one of our greatest actors. And, you know, as far as that category is concerned, I mean, I know Tom Cruise takes a lot of grief from people, but he is fantastic in Born on the 4th of July. He really is.
I've not seen that movie. I started watching it, and I think I got about 10 minutes in and then got distracted. So I need to go back and watch it. But, yeah, just, again, the 15-year-old me not really interested in that movie. So mm-hmm. I'll have to go back. All right, for Best Director, and this is a kind of a shocking Best Picture, Best Director split here, which we didn't see a lot until, like, the last 10 years. So your Best Director nominees were Jim Sheridan for My Left Foot, Kenneth Branagh for Henry V, Peter Weir for Dead Poets Society, Woody Allen for Crimes and Misdemeanors, and the winner was Oliver Stone for Born on the 4th of July. Then your Best Picture, My Left Foot, no shocker there given all the acting nominees. Field of Dreams, kind of surprising since they didn't get any other major award nominations. Dead Poets Society, Born on the 4th of July, and your winner, Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, I know that's one of the ones that's Best Picture choices that kind of is, I don't know what's the right word, reviled, or mm-hmm. people always wonder, how did that win Best Picture? But, I mean, the movies of that year, Born on the 4th of July is good, but it's not, mm-hmm. I would not be disappointed if it didn't win Best Picture. I obviously love Dead Poets Society, but no. I'm sure that people love Driving Miss Daisy just as much. You know, Field of Dreams is a great movie as well. As like you said, I'm surprised it got a Best Picture nomination. In my notes, I see that it got a screenplay nomination, okay. but it didn't get any other acting nominations as well. But yeah, I mean, I think it's 30 years on, and you're like, I mean, yeah, maybe we might not be watching Driving Miss Daisy on a regular basis, but I'm sure it's fine. You know, it's usually just a matter of what came out that year. I think the big thing from that year was there were a lot of people that were upset that Do the Right Thing didn't get more nominations than it did. You know, especially, you know, Spike didn't get nominated for Best Director. He got nominated for Best Screenplay, but it didn't get a picture nomination. And I wonder if that movie comes out now, if it had a better chance, if we get more eyeballs on it. You know?
Yeah, again, you look at the, you know, Best Pictures from the 1980s, and how many times do you hear somebody say, oh, you know, just last week I sat down and watched Ordinary People or Gandhi or, you know, Last Emperor Out of Africa. So,
yeah, 80s was a weird, I think you talked about it on one of your other podcasts, but the 80s was a weird decade in the regards that it had so many great movies and so many movies that have been memorable to people who grew up with them like we did. But yet the movies that won at the Oscars, especially the Best Picture winners, are ones that people don't really talk about as much anymore. It's kind of weird.
They're old people movies.
Maybe. And whereas the 80s is supposed to be more of like that younger generation type of decade, and yet the Oscar voters weren't really catering to the younger audience at that time.
No.
Yeah. So anyway, but how about we hand out some awards of our own?
Sounds good.
As we did on the 1988 episode, I would describe it as honoring the great Ron W. Miller, who founded Touchstone. We have our own Ronnie Awards, in which we pick. We'll just look at the acting categories and also Best Picture, and then another category that my wife had suggested, which I do like, which is Best Soundtrack. So we'll just get right into it. I'll start with a Best Supporting Actress, and my choice was Julie Kavner from New York Stories. I mean, she's only on screen for like a limited amount of time, but she really commands those scenes that she's in. It's just one third of a longer film. Her character, Treva, you know, it seems silly on the surface, but not to Julie Kavner. Like, she really owns all the character traits, the eccentricity, the peculiarity. I mean, it's a tall task to act opposite Woody Allen, but I think she really holds her own with ease. She'd worked with Woody twice before, and I really think he wrote the script to her strengths. She brings just a really good comedic punch to the best story in this three-part anthology film. I mean, when Woody's mother disappears in the film, the story starts to get a little stagnant, but I think Julie Kavner kind of comes back to save it. It's not, and I'm not the only one who thought that way, because Julie Kavner would go on to win the American Comedy Award for Funniest Supporting Actress in a Motion Picture. I did see that the other nominees were Carrie Fisher in When Harry Met Sally, Diane Wiest in Parenthood, and Shirley MacLaine and Olympia Dukakis in Steel Magnolias. So, again, high praise for Julie Kavner, who was my choice for the Best Supporting Actress. What about you, Chad?
Well, I had Julie Kavner as my runner-up in the Best Supporting Actress category. I went with Christine Lottie for Grey's Anatomy.
Okay.
You know, part of it is this year, you know, with eight movies, there's not a lot of female roles in these films, or at least, mm-hmm. you know, meaty substance roles. So it was more of like a process of elimination.
Sure.
To get here. And I just thought Christine Lottie, as we recently discussed on the last episode of Out of Touchstone, really handled the depth or the, you know, the substance of this medical professor trying to instill in her students to take medical school serious. And again, she's just a great performance by an actress who, as I said on the show, I know the name, but couldn't tell you anything she's in. And I think part of that is just a sign of a really good actress who doesn't overshadow the role that she's in. She just plays it very straight. And yeah, so Christine Lottie.
And now, now I just wonder about some of these brilliant doctors of mine, you know, with their minds for medicine and their hearts for what? Real estate? You know, I wonder what they'd say to some lonely, terrified patient who grabs their hand and says, "Can you explain this to me? Can you help me accept this? Can you at least sit with me so I don't feel so alone?" Well, I bet they don't say anything. Because I didn't teach them to.
It's not your responsibility.
No, but whose is it? I made doctors, Slovak. People need healers. Do you understand?
Yeah, and then, I obviously loved her as well in that film. From an honorable mention standpoint, like you said, I don't think this wasn't really a strong year for actresses in Touchstone movies. I mean, again, we only had 8 to choose from. But still, like, the only thing I could come up with was Mary Winningham from Turner and Hooch, and also Layla Robbins, who played Tom Selleck's wife in An Innocent Man. And I guess, to a certain degree, Rosanna Arquette's role in New York Stories, I think, was pretty strong. But other than that, I mean, did you have any honorable mention that I didn't mention?
No. Yeah. That's it. And, we'll get to those ones that you didn't mention a little bit later.
Yeah. Spoiler. So then I'll let you... Well, I think you're going to... I mean, we're gonna kind of go off the board a little bit on this. We had it last year, 1988, as well. But I'm very curious to see if our best supporting actor choices might be the same one. So I'm going to go ahead and let you start, Chad. Who did you have for best supporting actor?
I had an actor that, you know, I've probably seen in more films than I realize, but have never really thought about him in an acting sense, even though he's, you know, a great actor. And that is F. Murray Abraham for An Innocent Man.
Likewise, that's who I had as well. Chad, why did you choose F. Murray Abraham?
I just thought, you know, he has a small role in An Innocent Man, because you only see him during the prison scenes, but he just comes in and he owns every scene that he is in. I think he does kind of overshadow Tom Selleck a little bit, but I think that's not so much on an act, you know, because of he's so much of a better actor, but just the characters themselves. Tom Selleck is more of a meek character, whereas F. Murray is playing the, you know, kind of the prison lifer who knows all the ins and outs and how to survive. And so he's got that, again, I'm going to use the term weighted performance to really hold all those scenes together.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, he's one of the, like, our really finest actors. And I think this is honestly the result of casting an Oscar winner in an important role. I mean, this is what you're going to get. Like, I think I mentioned it to you on the show, but when we discussed that movie, when I saw that he was in it, I really thought he was going to be a lawyer of some kind. It's a movie about an innocent man, and you got him. But he kind of acts against type and takes on the role of, like, that hardened criminal, gives it some significant dramatic weight, as you mentioned. I also like that there was, like, a two-sided nature to his character. You know, at first you think he's going to be, like, this moral center, but then he also plays the inmate who is determined to see, like, quote, outlaw justice. Like, he's going to help Tom Selleck do some dirty stuff in the joint, you know? But Abraham is just perfect for the part, because you really don't know what to expect. He's an inmate, but, you know, he does kind of, did you notice he smiles quite a lot, whereas Tom Selleck is, like, constantly scowling through the movie while he's in prison. You know, it's like, is Virgil Caine, the character that he plays, is he pleased to be in jail? You know, I don't know. He balances the mean-spirited and sweet-natured aspects of that character, and I thought it was just fantastic.
Yeah. Must be nice to have Kate out there. Wait.
It's everything.
I feel like a kid every time she visits. I walk around for a week grinning like a maniac. She kept me strong.
Yeah, they do that, don't they? I had someone once.
All right, you got my attention.
I met her in a bar one night. Those days I was running and ripping. Just daring the man to catch me. Just trying to become a legend, you know? Lord, the things you remember.
You got that right.
She was there the night Parnell and Scalise busted me. She jumped all over him and they kicked the shit out of her.
You don't forget things like that.
Larkin!
Janie had heart. I'll catch you tomorrow.
From an honorable mention standpoint, and I think this gets mentioned a lot in the real Oscars, but what happens when you have multiple roles in the same film where the actors sort of what they do is they call it split the votes. Mm-hmm. And so F. Murray Abraham, he was fantastic anyway, but I found myself looking at both Fred Gwynne and Ruben Blades from Disorganized Crime. And again, we talked about it on the show, and I did confirm it. I saw an interview with Ruben where they asked him, how do you pronounce your last name? And he said, it's Blades. And then the host, it was Chris Hardwick, was talking to him about, I think it was after an episode of Walking Dead. And he said, well, I thought it was Blades. And he goes, well, it's also Blades. And you're like, huh? And he goes, well, I've always known it to be Blades, but in Panama, where I'm from, they pronounce it Blades. So it's like either or. And I'm like, I think it's more fun to say Blades. You don't get to say that name very often. Also splitting the vote, I had Gail Hansen and Kurtwood Smith from Dead Poets Society. Mm-hmm. Gail plays Charlie, and then Kurtwood Smith plays Robert Sean Lennon's father, and just both fantastic roles. Even Josh Charles and Ethan Hawke are both fantastic in that movie. But when you have so many different characters, like I said, they're going to end up kind of splitting the votes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only other honorable mention I could think of from the entire 1989 was maybe Giancarlo Giannini from New York Stories. He's got that one part in the Life Without Zoe, but I'm sure, you know, Life Without Zoe is kind of a forgettable part of New York Stories. Right. So did you have any other honorable mentions?
Well, I wanted to, you know, my love of these actors, I really wanted to give it to them. And that would either be Fred Gwynne, Lou Diamond Phillips, or William Russ from Disorganized Crime. Unfortunately, as we said on the show, that movie really didn't give them a whole lot to work with. Yeah. So I went just, you know, more out of a personal affection of this actor, I went with the Prince of Touchstone, Garland Sartain, from Blaze.
Yes. Sure. I knew you were going to go that one. I kind of set you up for that one.
Yeah, like you said, everybody in Dead Poets Society, you could pick out, and all of them gave great performances. All the actors in that movie, but for me, I'm stuffing the vote for just my own personal favorite, not necessarily the greatest acting role.
Yeah, we love Gaylord Sartain. Yeah. He's a favorite here. Well, you know what's so funny? We this happened on our 1988 episode, and I guess this happens in real life when you're dealing with the Oscars or the Golden Globes. Sometimes is you have to figure out is it a supporting role or a lead role? And sometimes I think they get put in different categories because of their increased chances to win. Mm-hmm. We're going to move on to Best Actress, and unfortunately, my choice for Best Actress was Christine Lavie. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't, not a very strong year for leads. And I really thought, you know, she was, you know, this movie is supposed to be about these medical students, you know, like Matthew Modine and Daphne Zuniga are prominently featured on the poster or on the DVD cover. But she kind of carries the movie, especially during those scenes where she's, you know, the instructional teaching scenes. You know, she's very understated and she has opportunities in the film to go over the top, but she always seems to kind of rein it in, you know, and then the character has drama of her own, but she gives it a very confident and assured performance. It doesn't really take anything away from the students, you know. I think we talked about it on the show, at least I did. The script has some issues, but she does great with the script no matter what. Like, you can't tell if the writers and the director were trying to make her like this evil and imposing professor, you know, but she's supposed to be hard on the students because she wants the best out of them. And I think Christine Lottie kind of handles the unclear nature of that character with grace. And, you know, what's so funny was I used my 1988 notes as a template and just kind of copied it. And then I just put in my 1989 choices and deleted over the old ones. And what's funny was for my choice for Best Actress in 1988 was Barbara Hershey and from Beaches. And the last line I had in my notes was one of the great highlights of a fairly underrated career. So I just left that note in for Christine Lottie in Gross Anatomy. So, I mean, again, is it supporting? You felt it was pretty strong enough to be for that role, and I understand that. But in my eyes, I really think she was the best part of that movie, and it ends up being kind of a lead performance.
Yeah, I went with Christine Lottie as a supporting actress just because I figured Daphne Zuniga would be considered the lead actress in Grey's Anatomy. So, but
yeah, I wonder if you will look back and see how much screen time did the two of them have compared to each other. Yeah. I'm sure I'd be surprised if it might be closer than we think, I guess. Yeah.
So for my best actress pick, I went with the only actress that I can remember from this movie, and that is Layla Robbins for An Innocent Man.
Okay, same situation. I had her as a supporting honorable mention, but yeah, she's pretty damn good in that role.
Yeah, she was good, and as I believe we mentioned on the show or on that episode, you know, I would be interested in seeing a movie about her character and what she goes through while the Tom Selleck character, her husband, is in prison for 6 years or 3 years, however long he ended up being in there, and how she's trying to get him, you know, free and talking to the inspector general or the attorney general, and just trying to. What's that?
I'll say the internal affairs.
Internal affairs, that's it.
And like you said, like I don't know about you, but those scenes in prison were so hard. Some of them were really hard to watch that whenever it cut to a scene with her on the outside, it was kind of a welcome relief.
Yeah. So, and I, you know, she's an actress. You mentioned Christine Lottie. Your note being I forget your exact phrasing, but a highlight in a, how did you phrase it? Not
under. Fairly underrated career.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, I don't know anything else that Layla Robbins has done. I don't recognize the name, but I thought she was really, really good in An Innocent Man.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I mean, again, and I don't mean to keep harping on it, but when you look at, like, honorable mention, I mean, the only other performance would be Lolita Davidovich from Blaze, and I didn't think she was all that great in it, so... That's sort of the damning statement of 1989 is that Touchstone is that they just did not really have a lot of strong female leads. And I don't know if that was indicative of the year 1989 itself. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're talking about how much I love Heathers, but I don't know about big studio pictures.
Yeah.
If you go back and look at those box office champs that you mentioned in the top 10. Yeah. I mean, Driving Miss Daisy. I mean, I'm sure there's Women in Parenthood, obviously Kirstie Alley and Look Who's Talking, but otherwise, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, that's a man. You know, 1989 seems to be more of a masculine year, even though one of the best movies of that year was Little Mermaid. So.
Exactly. Yeah, I had for my honorable mention, Mare Winningham. Again, the only actress in Turner and Hooch, so she kind of wins by default. But again,
yeah, and
I
just thought that more of a supporting part. It's so weird. Like, what do we consider lead and what do we consider support?
Again, because...
go ahead.
Oh, because she had no other... competition in that film, I just consider her lead. But yeah, how do you, is it screen time, is it the importance of the character in the role? I don't know.
I think it's just how you see it, and that's kind of how I looked at it. I mean, I felt like, you know, my issue with Turner and Hooch was the fact that it was like three movies in one, and she was only in sort of one of those three movies. You know, there was the dog. I mean, I guess she helped out with the dog lover stuff, but she was sort of the romantic comedy angle, and then she's not really part of the detective stuff. Like, it would have been different if she would have been taken hostage by one of the bad guys, and then Turner's got to save her or something. But yeah, on the flip side, as what ends up happening in the year before, 1988, with Touchstone, we've got a lot of great performances by lead actors. And so I'll let you go, Chad. Who was your choice for the best actor of 1989 Touchstone films?
Well, I think, you know, even though these are all male-dominated films, there really is only one choice for the best actor, and that's Martin Short in Three Fugitives.
Get out right now.
I think that's where you threw in either the crickets or the bocce balls sound effect. But now, I went with Nick Nolte for New York Stories.
Okay.
Just because I have a feeling my runner-up is probably, or my honorable mention is probably what you chose for best actor, but... You know, we said it on the show that Nick Nolte is a actor who, especially now, I don't think gets a lot of recognition because he hasn't been in a major film in I don't know how many years. But looking back, when you watch him on screen, he just has this presence about him. And I, you know, New York Stories, as we said, I think his role was probably the most, the best role out of all three stories. And, you know... Like I said, Disorganized Crime really didn't give anybody a good meaty role. Turner and Hooch, Tom Hanks is fine, but that innocent man, I just didn't feel Tom Selleck was that great in it. And Grey's Anatomy, Matthew Modine, like you said, he's the Zach Morris character in that film. So
for a minute there, I thought you were going to go with Matthew Modine because you spoke so glowingly of him on that episode. I know how much you enjoy his work. Yeah,
I do. And you know, again, if I didn't have a choice, kind of like the best supporting actor, where I went with a personal fave, just kind of like because everyone else split the vote, but Nick Nolte, I think, was probably the standout of 1989. Even though we've seen him in Down and Out in Beverly Hills, discovering Nick Nolte again was a highlight of 1989 Touchstone.
A performance artist. And he left you. Now you see through that, right?
I don't care. It's over. That's all. Look, I'm moving out. That's what I'm not coming back means.
Where are you gonna go? What can you afford? You gonna move into a dormitory? You don't want to sleep with me anymore? Hey, I'm a big boy. You don't have to go off the street. You had a fling. Big deal. Welcome to the world. I mean, we're still employer-employee, right?
I'm leaving New York. I want to go home.
Oh, yeah, well, that's a whole nother ball of wax. You want to split? Fine, come back, pack up, and go. You drag it out, I'll die, you know that. Come on, let's get it over with.
Yeah, totally, Chet. I totally agree. He's fantastic, and it's kind of a revelation in that movie. I mean, I wasn't as big on the life lesson story necessarily, but he was easily the best part of that with his acting. Once again, for my choice for best actor, we have that debate about is it support or is it lead? And honestly, I know the movie is supposed to be about Robin Williams being the star, but my choice for best actor was Robert Sean Leonard. Robert Sean Leonard from Dead Poets Society. You know, again, he could have been, the part could have been played as like a rich kid with problems stereotype that we've seen in so many films, but he makes the character of Neil Perry so much more human. You know, he has shortcomings for sure. You know, like he doesn't tell his father about being in the play, but you know, he does an excellent job of showing, you know, that fear and internal doubt and worry with a lot of like good nonverbal acting. You know, he's fantastic at fitting into the ensemble with ease. You know, most of the students get their chance to shine in the film, and he shines the brightest. And it's hard to believe that he was only 19 when he made that film. You know, like I said, the movie Robin Williams is the one that's plastered all over the poster and in the trailers and stuff. But I really thought that Robert Sean Leonard walked away with the strongest performance in the entire film.
Well, I thought you were going to go with Robin Williams, and I think I mentioned it on the episode where, yeah, Robin Williams is good, but to me, he's Robin Williams, and he doesn't show the acting chops that I think he showed like later on in Good Will Hunting. It's Robin Williams just kind of riffing and doing his Robin Williams shtick in the 50s. So
yeah, but let me ask you this, because Robin Williams was also, I mean, one of my honorable mentions.
Yeah,
and mine you mentioned he's the one that gets the Oscar nomination, but yet, like, if you look at it, I don't know. Like, if you had seen this movie, if you had not seen this movie and you'd heard that he'd gotten an Oscar nomination and you saw him all over the cover of the DVD and whatnot, and then you watched it, like, would you think that this was Robin Williams' like bravado performance? Yeah, he does a couple voices. I mean, I don't even know if he was. Do you think he was better in this or in Good Morning Vietnam? Like, he got Oscar nominations for both.
I would say this movie, because Good Morning Vietnam, we didn't do a year in wrap up for 1987, but I would have said. And I think I said on the episode where that movie was just too much Robin Williams shtick for me to really appreciate the character. But, you know, I wonder if Robin Williams got the nomination because, one, he was a well-known actor, whereas the other cast members were, you know, and a lot of them, it was their first or you know, early in their film careers. And so the Academy kind of has this tendency to make you earn it unless you have just a standout performance that everyone's talking about.
Sure. So. Also, I think it was probably I totally buy that. And I also think that sometimes the Academy loves it when you're a zany comic actor and you do something serious.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to happen way too many times. And I think it's one of the reasons, I mean, he's fantastic in Good Will Hunting, but I think it's what kind of he got that Oscar sewn up so early on in the process, because that was just like one of these sort of breakout changes, you know, when his persona kind of changed in the late 90s to something that could carry on those roles that were a little bit more heavy dramatically. We mentioned we both had him on our honorable mention. Did you have anybody else in your honorable mention for best actor?
You know, shockingly, I did not, after everything that I just said, but he was the only one that I listed. I only listed one for each category, but I agree with you that Robert Sean Leonard is perfect in Dead Poets Society.
Yeah, and I like Tom Selleck in An Innocent Man. I really thought, if you're looking at just honorable mentions, I mean, I don't think I could ever elevate him to that best actor, you know, spot, but it's for an honorable mention. You know, Paul Newman is great in Blaze, but it's like you said, it's annoying watching him fumble through this accent and mumble, but he's still a great actor, you know. And then in a weird way, I'm like, you know, Tom Hanks's role in performance in Turner and Hooch was pretty good if we're just looking at honorable mentions, but yeah. So, we only got two more left. What do you want? Do you want to do best picture, then soundtrack, or which comes first?
Let's do picture, because I think soundtrack will be. I think picture will tie into pretty much a lot of what we've said, where soundtrack might be a different conversation.
Well, sure. Well, okay. Then I'll just jump in and say it then, because I would imagine your choice is probably going to be the same, at least I hope. But the best picture of 1989, which is really one of the best pictures that Touchstone Pictures ever released, is Dead Poets Society. I mean, I had a terrible feeling going in this year when I looked at the list of movies. It was like, okay, one of these is going to stand out more so than the rest. You know, it's skillfully directed by an expert craftsman, Peter Weir, on top of his game. You know, he gets the most out of a group of young actors with very limited experience. The script has depth. All of the characters are well-rounded. You know, the students are flawed, but they're confident. And the adults are stern, but they also have good intentions. You know, some of the drama might seem a little forced, but I think it's indicative of what likely would have happened in a similar real-life situation at that time, you know. In a way, it's the kind of movie that I enjoy, where it's escapism at its finest. You know, it's set in an all-male boarding school in the wintry Northeast, you know, and I got completely wrapped up in it. It kind of made me miss college to a certain degree, you know. And in addition to the dynamic acting from the students, you know, you get a mostly subtle performance from Robin Williams, and you just get a sweeping and uplifting drama from just some very talented filmmakers.
I'm hearing rumors, John, about some unorthodox teaching methods in your classroom. I'm not saying they've had anything to do with the Dalton boys' outburst, but I don't think I have to warn you, boys his age are very impressionable.
Well, your reprimand made quite an impression, I'm sure.
What was going on in the courtyard the other day?
Courtyard?
Yeah, boys marching, clapping in unison.
Oh, that was an exercise to prove a point. Dangers of conformity.
Well, John, the curriculum here is set. It's proven it works. If you question it, what's to prevent them from doing the same?
I always thought the idea of education was to learn to think for yourself.
At these boys' age, not on your life. Tradition, John. Discipline. Prepare them for college, and the rest will take care of itself.
All valid points, and I think had we done this back in 1989, I probably would have agreed with you, but I think my best picture pick is more for how surprised I was to enjoy the movie, whereas Dead Poets Society, having seen it before and knowing so much about it, it didn't live up to the expectation. It didn't hold up as well as I was hoping. So my pick for best picture is An Innocent Man, because I was kind of blown away by how much I enjoyed the movie up till the last 10 minutes.
Oh, those last 10 minutes are just terrible.
And I think,
but I mean, it's the only honorable mention pick that I had for Best Picture this year. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think if you rework those last 10 minutes, you've got a really good, a really strong film. And I'm with you. The only honorable mention that I could, you know, safely say is a Best Picture nominee would be Dead Poets Society.
Yeah. And it's funny because I find myself, you know, when we're watching these movies to maybe try to bring some attention to them. If there's anybody who's curious about, oh, I don't know that one, or I haven't seen that one in a long time. And I think An Innocent Man is a movie that we would really recommend. And we really say, hey, go check this out. Yes, some of the scenes are going to be a little hard to watch. And yeah, if you happen to have caught Sledgehammer back in the 80s, it is a little weird seeing David Rash playing like a serious cop, even though he's kind of a dimwit in the movie. But yeah, and what's funny was we talk about, when we were discussing our picks for Best Picture in 1988 on that episode, we broke it down. We also had a separate category where we chose like our most surprising and most disappointing. And yeah, most surprising is this, it's an innocent man. Like, yeah. I went into this, there was a part of me that was kind of dreading some of these movies. I'll be honest, I dread watching them because I'm just like, I hope it doesn't feel like a chore or like it's going to be work. You know, you look at the topic, you look at the premise. Some of my, I try not to watch a trailer. I just go, oh, what is this? Tom Selleck's going to jail. It was like, okay. And then I literally was on the edge of my seat because I mentioned it on that show. You don't know what's going to happen. You really don't know what's going to happen. Any of these characters, you're like, is he going to kill this guy? Is he not going to kill this guy? Is he going to do this? And it's, you're right. It has to be your choice for the most surprising movie of the year, right?
No, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Cause it's the only one that I really didn't know anything about. I mean, New York Stories, I also was unfamiliar with, but Innocent Man, I vaguely remember the movie even existing before we watched it. And, you know, again, surprised at how well I'm like you, like I was not necessarily on the edge of my seat, but I was very invested in, okay, what's going to happen next? How are they going to, you know, get out of this? What's going to happen with the cop? Because he's in prison and the cops are on the outside. How are they going to work out? And then, like I said, the last 10 minutes, the movie does kind of fall apart. But personally, that's a flaw that I see in a lot of films is how do you wrap up a film and do it in a satisfactory way? So I can kind of overlook that, but definitely Innocent Man is the biggest surprise of 1989.
And if anything, I would recommend it to people just to watch it, as we said, for F. Murray Abraham's performance as well, which is fantastic. I'm curious to ask you, Chad, what was your most disappointing film of 1989?
I think you know where I got to go. I got to go with Disorganized Crime. Because
same here.
you know, when I saw that cast, Fred Gwynn, William Russ, Lou Diamond Phillips, Ruben Blades,
Ed O'Neill,
you know? Daniel Roebuck, Corbin Burnson, Hoyt Axton. Yes. I'm like, okay, this is a surefire comedy, great film. I'm going to enjoy it. And unfortunately, when it was over, I was just like, man, that was disappointing. Hence, most disappointing film of 1989.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. I mean, again, I made a mention of it on the show, but I bought this movie on Blu-ray when I first got my Blu-ray player years ago because I remember my parents seeing it on TV and liking it, and I'm like, oh, it's got to be good, right? I'm sure it's – I mean, it was only a few bucks at a store, but I was like, I'll get it. I'm sure I'll still be entertained by it, and man, it was just frustrating because you're like, this could have been so much better, especially with that cast. So anyway, all right, we'll end with our final award, which would be the best soundtrack. I'm going to start – again, I kind of alluded to it on that particular episode, but my favorite soundtrack of 1989 was New York Stories. And I think a lot of it comes from the first story in the anthology, which is Martin Scorsese's Life Lessons, because it includes, you know, White or Shade of Pale by Procol Harum, Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan, Nighttime is the Right Time by Ray Charles, and one of my favorite songs by Cream, which, the song Politician, you know, and then even if you look at the other stories, The Life Without Zoe has that really great score by Kid Creole and the Coconuts, and then the Woody Allen story, you know, he's kind of known for using big band and jazz music in his movies, and so the Benny Goodman song Sing Sing Sing, which is also in Big Business, it's just perfectly placed. I mean, I really think that Martin Scorsese, the Life Lessons story, the soundtrack really gives it life. You know, it's kind of a slow story, and the music provides a lot of energy. I think I mentioned it on that episode, but I'm not smart enough to know if the songs are supposed to coincide with Nick Nolte's feelings or not. Like, certain songs play when he's productive, and certain songs play when he's having, like, a mental block. But I think they're used to great effect. And like I said, he's so well known for using popular songs in his soundtracks, and this is a highlight. And then even, like I said, the Life Without Zoe story, which is kind of forgettable, but Kid Creole's music, it enhances the whimsical nature of that story, especially when you look at it as being told from a child's point of view. It's very vibrant and fun. And so, yeah, I mean, I know we didn't have a whole lot of choices to choose from this year, but I really enjoyed the music in New York Stories more than the film itself.
You know, looking at the best soundtrack, I don't really pay attention, or songs really don't stick out to me unless they're used specifically in a scene that I can tie the song to the scene. And all the songs you mentioned in New York Stories, as I mentioned on that episode, I don't know those songs. So they didn't resonate with me as any type of character music relationship. So looking at the best soundtrack for 1989, you know, in 1988, we had Cocktail, we had Beaches, which were two kind of iconic soundtracks that, you know, even Who Framed Roger Rabbit to an extent with the songs that are in there. So I went, you know, without really knowing, without having any of these movies really sticking out to me, I went with Blaze just because I am a fan of, you know, folk music, of the Southern, Southern musical jazz type New Orleans sound. And there's nothing on the soundtrack that I could name off the top of my head other than Hank Williams Sr.'s Hey Good Lookin', and I'm actually using my phone to look up the soundtrack right now.
But, there's a great Fats Domino song on there called One Night, and I mentioned it on the show, but the song that plays in the closing credits of Blaze is by Randy Newman, and it's called Louisiana 1927. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was totally expecting you to pick Blaze as your choice. It's one of my honorable mentions. I was giving you, I knew you were going to choose it as yours.
Yeah, I just, I enjoyed that. But again, the other movies I don't really remember, other than New York Stories, are because the music is used when Nick Nolte's painting. Again, I don't know the song, so they didn't resonate. But all the other movies, I don't remember like any specific musical cues being used. So Blaze kind of won by, again, process of elimination.
Well, again, like I said, as soon as I was watching it, I just thought the music in this movie is going to really go to Chad's liking. And I haven't mentioned it to you yet, but I really felt like the soundtrack of this movie reminded me of standing in line for the Radiator Springs Racers ride at Disneyland, that same sort of folksy Americana. And I always talk about how much I hate being in that line because that music can be a little grating after a while. And every time you and I have ever stood in line for that ride, you always seem to enjoy yourself. So I kind of figured as much it would be Blaze. The only other honorable mention I had was Gross Anatomy, just because I had, you know, it's got She Drives Me Crazy by the Fine Young Cannibals, and it's got that Starship song over the closing credits, and then I like Doris Day a lot, so there's a Doris Day song in there. But otherwise, like you said, is there a whole lot of other soundtracks that year that struck out? Any other honorable mentions? Because I couldn't think of anything.
No, other than, you know, if hard-pressed, I would have said New York Stories. But
yeah.
And even Gross Anatomy, even though as of this recording of this episode, we had just talked about it a couple of days ago. I completely forgot about every song that we've mentioned in the discussion. So, again, it's, you know, if I hear Stuck in the Middle with You, I instantly think Reservoir Dogs. If I hear Time of My Life, I think Dirty Dancing. It's song, if you tie a song directly to a scene, it is more memorable to me than if you just play music as a music bed.
Yeah, sure. And like I said, that's totally agreeable. I find myself looking at songs on soundtracks a lot more now just because I always want to try to find a good song to use for these episodes. But at the same time, I'm a big fan of the use of music in movies. And so, like I said, when we included this category for best soundtrack, I didn't want it to be like, it didn't have to be an official soundtrack release. I just wanted to look at the way that the music was used in the movies. So, well, that's it. 1989, I guess. If you look at it on the whole, like I said, maybe not the greatest year for Touchstone. They get a Best Picture nomination and some decent and some underrated movies. But the final note that I have here is that, you know, if you throw out Three Fugitives, you know, for being dumb, and you throw out New York Stories for being an anthology, you're pretty much left with Dead Poets Society and, you know, five films that all could have been great, could have been greater than they were, but they lacked focus and took shortcuts by either opting for like a cheap humor or for some sort of instant gratification to try and please the audience. And I say that as someone who admired Innocent Man, but we both know it could have been even better. You know, I know your favorite quote from a lot of these Touchstone movies, when you describe them, is you say they're like two or three rewrites away from being perfect. And I think 1989 was a great example of that. Movies that had great premises and then just, I don't know. I mean, it's not who are we to judge? You know, art is subjective, but I found myself going, God, if they would have just done this instead of that, I would have liked these movies a whole lot better. And it was almost every single one of those movies for a while. Go ahead. Yeah. Any final notes?
Yeah. I was going to say, I was kind of disappointed in 1989 as a whole for Touchstone. And I'm looking ahead to what we have in 1990, and I'm curious to see how we end up that year, because looking at the list of films, there's only, you know, I'll be completely honest, there's only one movie in here that I'm looking forward to watching. So I'm expecting a lot of hopefully happy discoveries in 1990.
Yes, I think that's kind of the whole point of this podcast, Chad. I mean, it started all the way in 1984 with Country, you know, and some of the other random movies that we would have seen you know, like offbeat and stuff like that. And so, again, I feel like 1990 is going to see, we're going to see, there are, like I said, a lot of people returning. We're going to see a sequel to a Touchstone movie. We're going to see a comic strip adaptation. We're going to see one of the highest grossing movies that Touchstone ever produced. But we're going to start it off on the next episode with two, what should be kind of interesting movies. One of them is the sixth of seven films starring the queen of Touchstone, Bette Midler. And the other movie, I believe, might be the lowest grossing movie of all of the films that Touchstone has ever produced. And that you talk about trying to be pleasantly surprised. I'm trying to lower my expectations, but I'm hoping, based on the cast of that film, that I might end up coming out with a smile on my face, or I might say, you know what? There's a reason this was the lowest grossing movie.
They could have called this Disorganized Crime 2, but... Yeah, looking at the list, I've only seen three of these films from 1990. So, if anything, at least it will be a good discovering experience.
Yeah, and it should make the Ronnie Awards pretty interesting for next year. So that's our Ronnie Awards for this year. Again, we hope we'll you'll tune in as we go into the 1990s on our next episode. Once again, my name is Mike DeKalb. You can find me on Twitter at Mike DeKalb. I also run the Out of Touchstone Twitter account @OutofTouchstone. If you want to email us, please, outoftouchstone@gmail.com. My co-host, Chad Smart, you can find him on Twitter, @ChadSmart. He also is the proprietor of the Positive Cynicism Podcast Network, the #PCPN. So, Chad, is there any other thing you want to say to wrap up the 1980s with Touchstone?
All I can say is I'm looking forward to a new decade of Touchstone films, and we'll see what happens. But, 1989. I think it's best if we just move on.
Huh? For Chad, I'm Mike. This is Out of Touchstone, and we're out of time.
Out of Touchstone is a Honey Nerds production. For more information, visit outoftouchstone.com. Like and subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
So, you're cool, I'm cool, we're cool, thank you, good night.